This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Now here's something that came as a surprise to me, and I'm imagining it's going to come as a surprise to a lot of you as well. Our nation is in the midst of a silent epidemic of toileting troubles. No one gets onto Facebook and says, oh, my kid wet the bed again, but accidents and bedwetting and urinary tract infections are rampant and they're on the rise. These messy and, you know, embarrassing problems are stressful for parents and for kids alike, but they're typically dismissed. You know, kids are kids or shall outgrow it, or they're misdiagnosed or they're undertreated. And that's because most parents and many pediatricians are not aware of one very important research-proven fact. Virtually all childhood potty problems are caused by holding the poop or the pee or both. A lot of the problems have to do with our Western lifestyle and the pressure that we put on parents and kids to get toilet trained too early. There's also inadequate potty training follow-up and misguided school policies. In today's show, we're going to get, if you'll forgive the expression, the real poop about potty problems from a doctor who actually specializes in these kinds of things. We're going to learn how to recognize the sometimes subtle signs of holding it in, and we're going to get some research-based strategies for resolving all of the wetting and holding episodes that may be causing your child and you a lot of stress.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
I'm 4 years old, and I'm the only one in my whole class that can tie his own shoes.
My mom took me to the circus for my birthday. Half my friends already went, but now I've gone too.
Most kids make fun of me because I still believe in the tooth fairy. But I got $5 yesterday. I believe.
A third of the kids in my 8th grade class drink alcohol regularly.
Over 99% of my class has been offered illegal drugs. Half of my college classmates binge drink, abuse drugs, or do both. But the frequent dinners I had with my family have helped make sure I'm not one of them.
Go to CASAFamilyDay.org. Take the Family Day Pledge and get tips on how to talk to your kids about drugs and alcohol. Have dinner with them often, and you can significantly lower their risk of substance abuse. Dinner makes a difference. A message from the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Steve Hodges, who's the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wetting, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm curious, you have a completely different take on a lot of the potty training stuff, and believe me, I can tell you that I get an inordinate number of potty training books that show up here. And it was interesting. I don't want to say refreshing exactly, but it was a little kind of coming from left field. Tell us about your particular take on these things.
Yeah, so in my clinic, it was clear to me early on in my career that early toilet training was bad in terms of it led to more problems, and I saw that just every day. And then when I looked through the literatures, it was interesting that most of the data is actually the opposite, and that may be what you're referring to, is a lot of data shows that if you train later, you can have worse problems with incontinence or overactivity. I think the last paper I saw showed that very early training was bad and then late training was bad, so there was a magic window around 2. And so I did my own study before the book came out, and we actually got the same data, which was shocking to me, that, you know, early training was bad and late training was bad, and around the middle, it seemed to be a magic window. But it didn't make a physiologic sense to me, because I know what causes bladder overactivity and what can lead to it. So we looked a little deeper, and we found that the kids that most studies that have been published said that trained late and had problems were almost assuredly already either constipated or had some bowel issues which were hampering bladder function, so they didn't really have a chance to void normally.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the kids we see either train late and were constipated, or tried to train early and were constipated and then had difficulty training, so didn't train until they were much later.
Okay, so let's talk about a little bit of an idea about what this whole window is. When you're talking about early and late, I mean, you hear every once in a while somebody will talk about how, well, in Sweden or whatever, you know, they're toilet training their kids at 9 months or 6 months or something like that, and there's occasionally a book that shows up about how you can potty train your child at 6 or 8 months. That seems way early to me, and so I would like to get a little bit of a better sense from you about what early is and what late is, and you said about two, but there's a difference for boys and girls, right? So,
yeah, I think in general, I consider them as a group. I mean, sometimes it seems like girls train a little easier, but I wouldn't try to train any child before three. And I think the disconnect or the misunderstanding people have is that when it's possible to train a child and when it's wise to train a child are very different. It's possible to train them very early. And in certain countries maybe where there's different diets or different access issues to the bathroom, maybe bathrooms are more available, it may not be as big a deal. But in America, where I can speak personally, training early is a bad problem, because the way you need to look at it is that from the age of toilet training on is when the child, the decision to whether when the child goes to the bathroom is in the child's hands, right? So the earlier that happens, the worse it is, really, because children often make poor decisions in terms of when to go to the bathroom. And that early holding, because they'll always put it off, leads to more problems later. So we have actually really pretty good studies out there about bladder growth, and we see that the bladder grows when it has kind of uninhibited emptying, when you're just emptying into a diaper. And that growth tapers off rapidly after training. So these kids that we see in my clinic with wetting and accidents and so forth, that problem developed from training on.
Go back just a second, though, because I didn't quite get that whole thing about the bladder growth.
So, yes, this is an interesting point. So the bladder is a muscle, but it grows. When you're born, it's not a huge size, and it grows in the first few years of life because the gentle stretching of the bladder, which happens as it fills, because, you know, an infant doesn't void until it's a reflex happens. It doesn't really make a decision to void. It just reflexively empties the bladder.
Mm-hmm.
And that gentle stretching and then emptying without holding is what leads to bladder growth. Once you start feeling the urge to void and kind of preventing it by holding it, you strain the bladder, and it makes the bladder wall thicker because you're straining the bladder. And as you imagine, if you have a circular or spherical organ, as the wall gets thicker, the actual volume it can hold gets smaller.
Oh, that's interesting. I would have thought it'd be exactly the opposite, which is, I guess, what most people think, is that if you hold on to it, there'll be more and more and more in it, and then you'll eventually have a bigger bladder.
Oh, yeah, that's such bad advice, which is very common. One of the reasons we wrote the book, because a lot of pediatricians, even well-meaning pediatricians, will tell children if they have urinary frequency or urgency just to try to hold, to kind of train the bladder to hold more.
Mm-hmm.
But the bladder is a muscle, so the more you strain it, the more it hypertrophies or get bigger, just like any other muscle. But also, as it lays down more muscle, it kind of fibroses a bit, so it gets harder, so it becomes less compliant. So it turns from kind of a balloon with a thin wall to a balloon kind of with a thick wall, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
So it's much harder to expand and hold urine, and that's what causes a lot of the problems.
Is that a permanent change? Or if you went back to more of a normal usage, that you would eventually, in the same way that if you didn't work out a lot, your muscles would get a little smaller?
Exactly. It's temporary, and kids have great recovery, you know, because they're so pliable and they can recover from anything. So the sooner you reverse that process, the bladder can recover and get bigger again. So that's one of the first steps we do is kind of we take away the inhibition in these children. We put them on a voiding schedule, so they're not kind of deciding when to go anymore, but the parents are telling them when to go.
Now, one of the things I thought was really interesting about the book and the materials that I got that I was looking at before we set up this interview was the idea of holding it, and that really seems to be at the core of a lot of the problems that there are. How does that work? I mean, you're saying that it's thickening the wall of the bladder, but you're also talking about holding not only urine.
Oh, yeah, so there's two components, and I actually think the stool component happens first, because I think it's a little bit easier for kids to learn to void in the potty as opposed to pooping in the potty. And when they've changed their diet to maybe whole milk or regular food, they for the first time start having painful bowel movements. And they're just like anyone, if something's painful, they'll tend to put it off a little bit. And so as they withhold going to the bathroom to poop, it can build up behind the bladder. So that excessive stool can cause pressure on the bladder and then make the bladder overactive, which then causes them to hold the bladder more. So you get kind of this positive feedback loop where the holding just progressively becomes worse, and then you see the bladder of activity being initiating due to the bowel issue. But then once the bladder has become hypertrophied or changes due to the chronic holding, then it's got issues of its own. And then we see this a lot in some kids that will present with minimal symptoms, such as a urinary urgency or frequency, where they have to go to the bathroom quickly or frequently. It's almost solely due to the bowels. But as they progress and get worse symptoms, such as daytime wetting, and most assuredly in those children, there's been some changes in the bladder itself, which need therapy as well.
You see a lot of kids like this. So you're not just a pediatrician, you're a pediatric urologist. So you're seeing, I'm guessing they only show up in your office when there's a problem.
Oh, yeah. I guess I do see a kind of a skewed population, because everyone in my clinic is someone that's had problems for a while. But it's literally half my clinic. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is that a lot of the parents would come in, and you know, a lot of times people maybe put off this issue, say, well, there's just a kid being a kid, don't worry about it. And so years go by before they see me, and the problem's a lot worse. And also, there weren't a lot of resources available for parents. If you're a parent, you know, there's common understanding for certain diseases, what causes them, you know, not to give a child like aspirin if they have measles or whatever for Reye syndrome. And there's things that are known out there, but in terms of why these wedding episodes develop, there's not good information for lay people. So that's one of the reasons we wrote the book, because parents come in with all sorts of theories, and most of them, you know, aren't based in fact.
So what's too late in this process? When is it too late to start
to train?
Yeah.
In my opinion, the problems I see, never. You know, I figure, and we, a lot of parents say the same thing when they're kind of on board with me. I mean, these kids, you know, your child's not going to go to college, you know, in diapers, obviously. So anytime they, you know, at some point, some peer pressure, or just, you know, they're the last kid in class in pull-ups, and they want to go. So there's rare kids that they'll be close to four, you know, or past four, and just not, they've been in diapers so long they don't want to get out of them. And at some point you do have to maybe force the issue and say, look, you know, we have to do it. And that's a little bit of trouble, but that's way easier than reversing the bladder overactivity that may develop in kids that train very early.
Stephen Hodges is the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wedding, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to continue talking with Stephen about some of the potty problems and also to get some real concrete information about how you do go about training a child and dealing with problems as they arise. I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
I walk and you drive. So let's make a deal. I'll watch for you and cross the street safely. You watch for me and stop. Think of the impact we can make.
A message from the Federal Highway Administration.
I don't recycle. I mean, we can just find another planet for your kids to live on, you know?
Noted non-recycler Tommy Crenshaw talks about the future.
Oh, I can totally see finding another planet that can support life when ours fills up with trash.
As an alternative to recycling?
Yeah, an alternative. So we, like, don't have to do it. Recycling. There are lots of planets. Finding one is just a matter of time.
Many people say that recycling is pretty simple and convenient. A matter of keeping select items out of the trash. A lot simpler than finding a new planet, Tommy.
Come on, there's a bunch of planets out there.
Would you recycle on this new planet, Tommy? Or just use it up and throw it away, too?
I really don't have a clue.
Log on to yougottabekidding.org and learn about all the ways you can recycle. Unless you're into lame excuses like Tommy's.
Hey, recycling's just not my thing. Starting over on a new planet? Now that's exciting.
Don't be that guy. Unless you want people looking at you funny. Log on to yougottabekidding.org.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and if you're just joining us, we're continuing our discussion with Stephen Hodges, who is the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wedding, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about, you've mentioned a couple times that you don't want to start too soon, you don't want to start too late. How do you go about starting and with a child who doesn't seem to be having any problems? How do you start? How do you figure out when they're even possibly emotionally ready for the whole thing?
They have to have, you know, an interest, first of all. Otherwise, you know, you're never going to win. And so typically, once they have an interest, and if they're after three, then you basically introduce the concept of going. They have to be able to dress and undress themselves. That's important because you have to get to the bathroom and be able to actually, you know, to void. They have to be able to tell you when they need to go and communicate that need and sense it themselves. I don't like to focus on the training as much because that's where the problems happen. What I like to focus and tell parents is, number one thing is make sure that once the child starts regular diet, that their stools are very, very, not loose, but soft and regular. A lot of kid parents will miss constipation children because they think that formed large stools are normal in children. The stools should be very mushy. We like to make food analogies like, you know, hummus or mashed potatoes or a thick milkshake. But that's really what you need. And early on, if you develop constipation issues as a child and they're not addressed, it can lead to difficulty training. So you need to talk to your pediatrician if your child has those problems, even in diapers, to see whether you need to add any laxatives or extra fiber to help that. And then once they're in the mode to where they're interested in training, you just have them go on a schedule and have them try to go. And usually they'll pick it up very quickly. But what you want to focus on is emptying. So what you don't want to do is make it difficult or something hard for the child to do or that they're punished for when they don't empty. You don't want them to be holding. Mm-hmm. So some kids, you know, catch on very quickly with toilet training and they fly with it. Others have difficulty. And those kids, I don't like to, you know, force them to drop, be dry or punish them, but keep them pull-ups if they need so they can go to the bathroom and release either in the toilet or in their pull-ups if they don't have time to get to the bathroom.
Now, I think one of the things I'm guessing you would probably be hearing a little bit of a pushback from some people, because a lot of people put their kids into daycare around age two or slightly before. And I remember when I was putting my kids in those situations, a lot of them want to have the kids potty trained by two. And so you're going to have all these parents who are going to be saying, oh, hold on just a second. You're suggesting that we now have to keep our kid at home for another year?
That's very true. That's one of the reasons I wrote another reason I wrote the book is that I think that forced training is bad because some kids aren't ready, you know. And I don't really see, you know, again, I don't want to tell other people their business, and I know it's difficult to take care of these kids, but I don't really see the harm in letting kids at any age come to a, you know, preschool or a camp in pull-ups, and if they have, you know, if they have to go, then just have them changed, because I really think we name certain causes of that we believe have developed this epidemic of potty problems in our children, and one of them is the school system or the preschool system, which encourages early training, and then once the children are trained, has them, you know, in an environment where maybe they're not comfortable going. So really it's a setup for problems, because you're taking a three-year-old kid, you know, that's really not gone to the bathroom on their own, and then forcing them out of pull-up, out of diapers, and putting them in an environment where maybe they may not be comfortable going. So you introduce holding very early, and we think that's bad.
One thing I'm kind of curious about is the, I don't know, overlap or the confusion sometimes between things like diarrhea and constipation. And you, in some ways, or not in some ways, you actually have a diagram of it, which is an odd-looking thing. But you're saying that in sometimes kids who look like they have diarrhea are actually constipated. How can you tell the difference?
Yeah, so that's a very important point. And one of the main components of my research has been just teasing out normal bowel habits in children, because the most commonly the children we see in my office with voiding problems, complaints such as urinary urgency or having to rush to the bathroom or urinary frequency or incontinence day or night while sleeping or while awake, have completely normal bowel habits. The parents will say, you know, they void daily, they have soft stools. Some of these kids I was treating were not getting better, I looked a little deeper into it and found that if you x-ray them, they actually are actually full of stool, mostly in the very end of the colon, called the rectum. So constipation, as the colloquial definition of, you know, voiding daily with soft stools, doesn't really fit with kids. With kids, what you got to make sure, if they're having voiding problems, is that their rectum or the end of their colon is empty. So a lot of these kids would come in, and we'd put them on laxatives, and the parents would quit the laxatives because they were having diarrhea, and they'd stop. So, but the voiding problems would still be there. So we'd bring them back, and we'd get another X-ray, and we'd see, you know, the stool is still there. And what happens is you have hardened stool at the end of the colon, and if you're flushing through a lot of laxatives, a lot of the loose stool will just pass around the hard stool and cause diarrhea, and you haven't solved the problem. So that's why I think it's important to image these children somehow, either with ultrasound or X-ray, to see exactly what's going on, because a lot of times what's coming out the bottom isn't really telling you the whole story.
Wow. Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about bedwetting and things like that that are going on well into the school years, 5, 6, 7 years old. Is that normal, and how, as a parent, can you deal with that?
Yeah, this is a kind of an area I'm trying to champion, and I don't want to be too dogmatic, but, you know, for the near, you know, recorded time in urology, we've had three common causes of bedwetting that we understood. One was that children that wet the bed tend to make a little bit more urine at night. Two was that they tend to be a little bit more difficult to arouse. And three was that their bladder was overactive. And since bedwetting was so common, we wouldn't even begin treating it until they were seven or so. And then we'd treat one of those three areas with various therapies that we have. What we found in our research is, and what was printed by Dr. O'Regan back in the 80s and somehow either misunderstood or kind of misconstrued, was that the majority of kids, actually the main cause is bowel issues, which are causing bladder overactivity, and that can be addressed very early and oftentimes cure these kids. Dr. O'Regan cured his own son at 4 by using enemas, and his child had normal bowel habits, and the only way he was able to diagnose the constipation was with an invasive test. So what I say is, in all kids with bedwetting, is first evaluate the constipation and treat that aggressively. In almost all cases, in fact, 80% of the time, that will take care of the problem at any age once they're trained. If that doesn't work, then you can look into the other options, which include either medicine or alarm therapy, which are also highly successful.
Now, it seems like a lot of people are going to have to be making doctor trips to figure this stuff out. Is there a way to diagnose these things on your own as a parent without having to do the copay and get everybody
in?
Yeah,
that's a good point. I fixed a few neighbors just over the phone, you know, by saying if you're wet in the bed, there's no harm in just starting some Miralax or another other type of osmotic laxative and see how the child does, and most of those kids just get better just off that. We have some recommendations on how to do Miralax kind of clean outs in the book, but you could even just start a daily dose or a low dose of Miralax to keep the stools. Well, we say we'd like them to be less than 2 centimeters wide, so thin stools, and to be mushy when they hit the toilet. And this is a weird thing for most people to talk about, but I'm kind of used to it.
Yeah.
But the poop, when it hits the toilet, it shouldn't be like a big log there. It should be like a cow patty, you know. And if you start that process, which will slowly empty out the colon, you most likely will resolve your bedwetting months to years earlier than you would have if you ignored it. So you can simply do that, and I bet you half the kids will get better just from that therapy alone.
Okay. All right, last thing we're going to talk about a little bit is diet that can help regulate and help deal with some of these issues. You talk certainly about fiber, but what else is going on in the potty training diet?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons, again, we cover three reasons in the book why we think these potty problems are prevalent in modern society, and one of them we think is just the highly processed Western diet. You know, I have my own kids, and I know how hard it is to get them to eat properly. You know, you could have all the right foods there, but you know, they may not want it because they've had a taste of the good stuff. So what you want to try to do is promote a wide variety of foods and whole foods, not so much the processed things. Kind of like if it comes out of a box, it's probably not got a lot of fiber in it. So if you can promote a good rounded diet in these children, and mostly whole foods, then you will prevent at least the painful stools that come along with eating high processed, low fiber foods that can lead to the behaviors of holding. And that's important to start off very early. Now, another important point is you could have 2 children, 3 children, feed them the same exact diet, and they may respond to that food differently. Some may have constipation, some may not. So you have to personalize your therapy. I've got a little jaded in terms of using diet to fix these children because I see the children at the end of the road, you know, where they're having severe problems, and typically just adding fiber, even if you had the perfect diet, wouldn't work. You need to add laxatives or other therapies. But before the problems have developed, if you can keep the diet high fiber, low-level processed foods, eating whole foods, then you're much better off to preventing these problems from starting in the first place.
Steve Hodges is the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wetting, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Steve, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My mom is a hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved, and then she helps them get out. Even when she can't breathe or see. Even when she's a little scared. My mom is a firefighter. She does great things. And the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration, a part of FEMA, reminds you to protect the heroes who protect our lives. Have a smoke alarm on every floor. Test it monthly. Replace the battery yearly. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, 60% of all fire deaths occur in a home without a working smoke alarm. The good news is, that's a fact that can change. For more information, visit the U.S. Fire Administration at www.usfa.fema.gov. Working for a fire-safe America.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Been getting a lot of email lately from women who are dating single dads, and this is one of the ones that kind of sums up a lot of questions that people have. Dear Mr. Dad, I'm a sixth grade teacher, and one of my students became very attached to me during the school year. Her parents divorced 8 years ago, and I began emailing with her dad a couple of months ago. We started seeing each other, but didn't let many people know because we wanted to wait until school was out. The daughter got wind that something was going on and told her dad it was wrong for him to date her teacher and begged him to date anyone but me. I wasn't expecting this reaction, and we stopped seeing each other. He said he had to do what was in his daughter's best interests. I completely disagree with this because the girl has not liked any of the girlfriends he's had before. I'm absolutely devastated. He thinks she'll come around now that school is over, but I don't think that's ever going to happen. Is there any hope? What should I do? Well, being a single dad myself, I can assure you that dating a divorced father is never easy. That's what women I've dated have said anyway, and I know I'm not the only one. We come with plenty of baggage, and there are always unforeseen complications. Plus, children tend to be very protective of their dads. I found it interesting that they're often more protective of dads than of moms, and I think that may be partly because they see that moms already have a lot more social support than dads do. Part of the problem may be that the girl feels betrayed by you. Because the two of you had such a strong bond during the year, chances are pretty good that she looked at you with admiration and respect and even considered you a friend. To have you suddenly dating her father might have made her feel that you were maybe just using her to get to her dad. It's also possible that the girl is worried about betraying her mother. Most kids with divorced parents secretly, or not so secretly in a lot of cases, hope that mom and dad will get back together, even if that divorce happened long, long ago. And there's nothing like having dad start dating someone else to show a child that A, she has no control over the situation, and B, that her fantasy of a reunited family might never happen. So the fact that the girl really likes you actually muddles things up even more by making her feel that she's actually helping shatter her own dream. As far as the dad goes, you need to understand that his first responsibility and his first loyalty will always be to his child, and that's the way that it should be. And while it's certainly worth trying to convince him to give things another go, his primary motivation will be to do what's right for his daughter, whatever that looks like to him. One thing you can do to help both dad and daughter come to grips with the situation is to slow the relationship down a little bit. In other words, try being friends instead of dating each other. Well, of course, it would have been better to have started the relationship from this angle. Going the friend route now still might work by giving everyone a little bit of extra time to get used to the new dynamic. At the same time, be sure to give dad and daughter plenty of space to talk things over. I know you want to get in there and tell your side of the story and try to show them that you've got the best of intentions, but don't. Dating a divorced dad can be frustrating and infuriating, but the key to success is being very, very patient. Rushing things is only going to backfire.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.